I don't have any new announcements for you this time. We'll have a we'll be having our first quiz coming up here in a week or so. I'll give you the exact date of it on Wednesday. It'll be either next week or the week after. But we'll talk a little bit more about that later. We've got some mastering chemistry assignments due this upcoming Friday, it looks like. I went on there and I saw that most of you have registered for mastering chemistry, and that's good. But if you have not yet, please make sure you do so as soon as possible. And if you're having any trouble with that, let me know. The file for the Spreadsheet 1 lab is supposed to be uploaded before lab today. Remember, for these spreadsheet labs, it's not like the other ones where we have formal reports or anything. All we need for the spreadsheet one is just that spreadsheet file that was uploaded, and that's it. So, spreadsheet 2 is what we're doing in lab today. So, I think that's about all I have to talk about, though. Does anybody have questions about any of the stuff that we're doing? No? Well, let's move right along with chapter 1. Let's see if we can't get through most of the rest of chapter 1 today like we have scheduled. So we ended last time, I think, talking about temperature and a little bit of calculations. But what we're going to do today is go through some of the different types of units, some of the types of calculations that need to be done in a course like this. A little bit about converting and sig figs and stuff like that. Alrighty, so let's start out with volume. What's volume defined as? The amount of what? Space that something takes up? The amount of writing there. Three-dimensional space that an object takes up. Volume is called a derived unit, because volume is not just something that is defined on its own. Volume comes from manipulating some other unit. So what unit are we manipulating in order to get a volume? Yeah, length. If we take a look at this cube here, it's a big cube with 10 centimeters on each side of it, right? That's the length of one side. Volume of a cube is length cubed. So if we know the length of one side, we do length times width times depth, essentially that gives us the volume of a cube, right? So this cube that we have over here, it's 10 centimeters of length on each side. Anybody know what 10 centimeters equals one of? Yeah, one decimeter. Deci is the SI prefix that is one larger than centi. Okay? So if I make centi larger, if I make the unit centimeters larger, that number 10 gets smaller. Okay? So as the unit gets larger, the number gets smaller. We talked about that before. So one decimeter is the same as 10 centimeters. So the volume of this cube is one cubic decimeter. So 10 centimeters is about that length. A centimeter is about the width of your pinky finger. So that's about 10 centimeters. So this one cubic decimeter that we're talking about is, it's about like that. It's roughly the volume of a softball. So it has a special name, though. Anybody know what one cubic decimeter is the same as? The most famous unit of volume. It's the base unit of volume, actually. What is it? It's actually the liter. It's actually the base unit. Okay. So if I have a 10 centimeter cube, 10 centimeter of length on each side, so that makes one cubic decimeter, that is 1 liter. So that's the official definition of a liter, the volume of a cube that's 10 centimeters by 10 centimeters by 10 centimeters. So That's why volume is a derived unit. It just came from a length. So if each side of this was 10 centimeters, how many cubic centimeters are in a liter? 1,000. I think it says right here, a 10 centimeter cube contains 1,000 cubic centimeters. Okay? Because it's 10 centimeters by 10 centimeters. Right? Length times width times depth. So, if there are 1,000 cubic centimeters in a liter, let's think back here. Let's look at our sheet of metric prefixes. So, we already talked about centi and deci and so on. So, let's just copy some of these down onto the other page. Deci, centi, milli, and so on. Just as a little reminder here. That deci is 0.1, centi is 0.01, milli is 0.001. Alright? This cubic centimeter, then, is going to have another name based off of how many of them are in a liter. So if there are 1,000 cubic centimeters in a liter, that means there are also 1,000 of some unit that's based off of liters. So, what do you think it's going to be? 1,000 what?
Milliliters.
Yeah, look at this. Milli, okay, means 0.001. If I think of this in terms of the math that's happening, here's the number 1,000. Milli is 0.001, or 1/1,000th. What's 1,000 times 0.001? 1. Okay. It actually works a little better if I just said 1/1,000. Okay. Because that's what milli is. So the math has to work out in order for this to happen. That's why there aren't, for instance, 1,000 kiloliters in 1 liter, because that would be like saying 1,000 times 1,000. It's a major point of confusion for students to understand whether we're talking about a large unit or a small unit. And that's why I keep trying to drive home this idea that if I have a large number, I need a small unit next to it in order to equal just one of the base unit. So from liter to milliliter, the unit got smaller and the number got what? From liter to milliliter, the unit got smaller, the number got larger. Okay? So it's sort of a balancing act. If I have a large unit, I need a small number of those, and vice versa. So try to keep that concept in mind, and you'll have a lot more success in dealing with SI units. The most common mistake for dealing with these prefixes is going the wrong way, making things bigger when you should be making them larger, and so on. So if there are 1,000 milliliters in a liter, that means 1 cubic centimeter is the same as 1 what? Yeah. If you work in healthcare or anything, you see that same unit referred to as the cc. That's just another way of saying cubic centimeter, but that's all the same unit. So they're all essentially interchangeable, although sometimes they're used more commonly in different situations. a cubic centimeter versus a milliliter. A cubic centimeter is used pretty commonly when we're talking about the volume of a solid, because that's sort of where its definition came from, length times width times depth. Cubic centimeter makes sense for that. Milliliter is used very commonly for volumes of liquids, because all of our graduated cylinders and syringes and pipettes and things like that are given in milliliters. So cubic centimeters is what you'll see on a syringe in a hospital or something like that. And even some of our syringes say cc's on them, but all the same. Right? So let's just see if we get this. So, I have blanks there. There'll be numbers in each of those blanks, and you could use scientific notation if you wanted, or you could use a decimal or something like that if you wanted. So, use what you know about milliliters and liters, and come up with a number to go in each of those blanks. Take just a second, see if you can figure that out. Also, think to yourself about what the relationship should be between those two numbers. Ready? Let's see here. We're going to do more groups today. Let's see how we should arrange ourselves. Let's just go by convenience. So let's see the four right there. The three there. Arranged yourself in a way that's specifically difficult for me to make into groups of three and four. You did that on purpose, didn't you? Right? In a couple weeks, I'm just going to make everybody number off. We'll go with it this way. Can't think of an easy way to do this. Let's do a group of 1, 2, 3. Okay? 1, 2, 3. 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, and 1, 2, 3. Okay? So just move over a couple of seats, you know, get so you can at least talk to your groups. Okay? And so you should move backwards and then you should move over. Okay? So move so you can at least talk to your groups. Yeah? Yeah? Yeah. 1, 2, 3. Okay. 1, 2, 3. Okay? So you guys in a group, right? Grumble, 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 yeah. I know. I'm mean for making you get up and move, aren't I? Alright. Make sure you got the same or similar numbers for these two blanks in your groups. And tell me what the relationship is between those two numbers. So discuss it. Make sure you come to the to a consensus within your group. What do you think? Why don't you move back a little? Forcing participation. This is just cruel. All right. So, this group of three in the front here, what number did you put in this blank right there? 1,000. 1,000?
1,000.
1,000th. Okay. Group in the back over there, what did you put? You put that exact same thing, that fraction? Okay, that's what I'm looking for. 1 × 10⁻³. Okay. Looks good. The three guys over there, what do you have? Speak up. 0.001? Yeah. Okay. Any of the remaining groups have anything different in in that box.
That works for me.
Let's see here. You three in the front here, what'd you put in the bottom blank?
1,000. Yeah, that's easier.
Okay. And then, you three back there. What is the relationship between this number and that number? What do you think? You know? Do those have anything to do with each other? Yeah, it's a reciprocal. That's exactly right. When we switch that relationship around, when we go from having one of the small unit to one of the large unit, it's the reciprocal of that number. So 1 times 10 to the 3 liters. Okay? 10 to the minus 3 to 10 to the positive 3. We talked about that last time. Changing that relationship around gives you the reciprocal of that relationship. All right? Anybody have questions about that? So, this one right here is going to be probably the most important one. You should be able to have it right on the tip of your tongue that 1 liter is 1,000 milliliters. So, this should make sense with what we've been saying all along. Which of these two, liter or milliliter, which of those is the larger unit? Liter. Liter is the larger unit, which means its number is what?
Smaller.
Okay? Questions? All right. So, density comes from a combination of two units. What two units? Mm-hmm. Yeah. In fact, density is mass divided by volume. Okay? And we would say that as mass per unit volume. So if I have a certain unit volume, yeah, go ahead.
So is that derived also?
Yeah, volume is a derived unit, or I'm sorry, density is a derived unit because it comes from mass and volume. Let's just write that, another derived unit. In fact, every metric unit is a derived unit from those main SI units that we started with. So everything that we deal with can come from some combination of those elements. So if I have a certain unit of volume, the amount of mass contained within that volume would be a measurement of density. So density is a little bit different from the others because it's called an intensive property. That just means density does not depend on amount. What is more dense? 1 milliliter of water or 20 gallons of water?
Same.
They have the same density because density is an intensive property. No matter the amount of water that you have, the density should be the same because density is a property of that substance itself. Is mass an intensive property? No. Which has more mass, 1 milliliter of water or 5 gallons of water? 5 gallons of water will clearly have more mass. So mass and volume themselves are directly related to how much of a substance we have. But because we've divided the two, because it's a ratio like that, if I have the same substance, if I double the mass, what will happen to the volume of that substance? Yeah, you'll double the volume, okay, with one substance. Now, different substances have different densities, but for any one pure substance, any pure sample of a substance, it should have a consistent density at a certain temperature anyway. So this table lists densities at 20°C. It is temperature related, so if temperature changes, density will a little bit. But look at water right here at right around 1.00. That's actually its density at 4°C, but I think that's around what its maximum density is. So that was actually the original relationship that essentially all of those mass units came from. Right? we wanted, we specifically defined water as having 1 gram per cubic centimeter. That's sort of the origin of that entire relationship. So water is just sort of our reference point in densities. Which of these substances will float on water? The ones with lower densities or greater densities? Yeah, take a look at this. Look at these things. Charcoal, ethanol, ice, all those things will float on top of water because they're less dense. So water is a little bit peculiar in that ice, in that the solid is actually less dense than the liquid. And we'll talk about that more later on. With most substances, that's actually not the case. So most substances, the solid actually is a little more dense. And that makes sense with those pictures we were dealing with last time. It actually looked like those solid particles were a little more smashed together than the liquids were. But water is different. The structure of ice is particular in that it has a little bit more open space than the structure of liquid water does. So, and that's a good thing because we want ice to float on the top of the water in order for fish to live in lakes, you know, during the winter and so on. So, take a look at, let's see here. I guess these are all just solids and liquids. Gas densities are usually in grams per liter. That's because gases are so much less dense than solids and liquids. We defined that earlier on in here, right? Gases have a lot of empty space in between the molecules. So rather than talking about how many grams there are in a cubic centimeter, we're talking about how many grams there are in a whole liter of that gas. That gives more reasonable numbers. So a lot of gases have densities of, I don't know, like, say, from 1 to 4 grams per liter for common gases. You know, things like nitrogen and oxygen and carbon dioxide are sort of in that range. Right? So, let's do a quick little calculation. If an object has a mass of 14.3 grams and a volume of 7.81 milliliters, what is its density in grams per cubic centimeter? So, equation for density is what? D equals m over b. Okay, so figure this out on your own. Get your calculator out if you brought it along. If you didn't bring a calculator along, at least get the setup written out. So do that calculation on your paper. Do mass over volume. Then be careful that your units are correct. You're going to have to use something from the last page to get the units that I gave you into these actual units. But compare it with your group members to make sure that you did the same thing. So, who haven't I talked to yet? This group back here, what'd you get?
1.83
grams. Mm-hmm. So, what you did is 14.3 grams divided by 7.81 milliliters, but what did we say about milliliters and centimeters cubed? Yeah. Okay. That makes sense to everybody? Those two are interchangeable units that we can really use at pretty much any time. Okay? Questions about density? We'll come back to density with a couple of calculations with it later on, but go ahead.
Just kind of unrelated, could the answer be 1.83 then, or 14.3?
We'll talk about significant figures in a minute, but since both of these numbers have three significant figures, two, three, our answer will be rounded to three significant figures. Okay. We'll go over those rules in just a minute. Right. Now that we're talking about things that we can measure, we need to have just a little discussion about how reliable one measurement is compared to another measurement. Right? So I have an object. Let's pretend that this object up here is the same as this object down here, and that we're actually not seeing the end of it. That these things are extending out, and we have actually lined it up at zero. Alrighty. The one on top, somebody from the front down here, how long at least is that object based on the ruler up on top? Yeah, absolutely. It is at least 8 centimeters. Okay. With this one down here, can you say anything different about how long that object is, at least? Somebody from the front here. Yeah, it's at least 8.6 centimeters. So we have a little better idea of what the length of it is using this ruler down here. So we know on this top one that it's at least 8. What I'm going to do in making this measurement is I'm going to add one more digit after what it is that we know explicitly. It's called the uncertain digit. And every measurement will have exactly one uncertain digit to it. So we knew this 8 with certainty because it's written right there on the ruler. Okay. I would not get an argument from anybody, I hope, that this is at least 8 centimeters. But let's estimate one digit beyond that. Okay. Somebody from over here, what do you think this is? Estimating one more digit, 8 point what? What do you think? 2? 3? Something like that? Okay. Because it's an uncertain digit, though, different people will estimate it slightly differently. Depending on how you squint at it, you know. So that uncertain digit, that's why it's called an uncertain digit. It's going to have some wiggle room to it. So keeping track of that and sort of understanding what effect it has is going to be a major part of making any type of measurement in here. So on the ruler down below, somebody from the back group over there, and you folks, what kind of measurement would you make for this one? 8. What? 8.6? 8.6, is that good? Have I included one uncertain digit in that measurement? No. What do you think? 8.6, what?
6.
2? Take a look at this. Here, if I help you out, here, I know how to help you out. There. Now what do you think? Yeah. It looks to me about halfway between those two, right? So when a measurement is about halfway between two tick marks, what's the uncertain digit going to be usually?
5.
Yeah. But, like I said, it's an uncertain digit. Different people could have estimated a little differently. 8.64, 8.66 maybe. There's wiggle room. There's variation in that last digit. So we're going to assume that every measurement or every set of measurements will have a certain amount of variation to them. If I had these three measurements. How much are those three varying by? Yeah, that's plus or minus 0.01 centimeters. And I just gave you that simple example there, right? Because I've got one in the middle, one below it, one above it. Okay. These three values up here, 8.3, 8.2, and 8.4, those are varying by plus or minus what? 0.1. So, if you're just repeating a set of measurements with the same ruler, then the variation of those measurements that you'll get will be dependent on how far apart those little marks are. Right? If we have marks every centimeter, we can expect our variation to be somewhere less than a centimeter. In this case, it was 0.1. If our marks were every 0.1 centimeters, our variation should be something that's less than 0.1. In this case, it was 10 times less. So that what I showed here is just sort of a crude example of standard deviation. And that's a statistical function that we'll be using in lab today. Excel can calculate a standard deviation for an entire set of data. And that just essentially tells you how much it's varying from the average. From the middle of it. So standard deviation is a measure of uncertainty. And it's related to precision. A small standard deviation, or a smaller standard deviation. Is that going to be a less precise set of data or a more precise set of data? Small standard deviation equals more precise. So precision is actually inversely related to something like standard deviation. Does that make sense? So if we want to have a very precise set of data, that means all of our values will be very close to each other. That means the standard deviation will be as small as possible. So anytime in lab this semester, when you have a series of values that should be the same or should be very similar to each other, we'll calculate the average and we'll also calculate the standard deviation, and with the goal being to have as small of a standard deviation as possible in our calculated data. But that only works for a set of values that should be the same in an ideal circumstance. That make sense? So precision is what we were talking about here. Precision is just how far apart any two values are, or any values are in a set of data, how far apart from each other they are. Okay? That is completely separate from accuracy. I've got precision down on the bottom. We'll get to that in a second. But accuracy or correctness and precision or repeatability are two separate measures of the quality of a measurement or a set of measurements. So measurement quality comes from those two things. So accuracy is just closeness to an accepted value. Okay. Precision is just how close values are to each other. Okay. And we set up above that standard deviation is the way that we quote precision, okay, in that we want to minimize standard deviation. Let's write that. For accuracy, we use percent error. So we'll talk about this a little more in lab, but the absolute value of a experimental value minus a theoretical value, all divided by a theoretical value. So, you'll usually be recording a value and then comparing that against some accepted value. So the difference of those values as a fraction of what the accepted value is, and then make a percent out of that. So if you have made very accurate measurements, if you made perfectly accurate measurements, what should the percent error be? Zero, right? Because the difference will be zero, right? If all of your values were exactly the same, what would your standard deviation be? Zero. So in lab, it will, since there's uncertainty in every measurement, our accuracy, our percent error will never be zero. It'll always be some non-zero value. Our standard deviation will always be some non-zero value. And in fact, if I see zero values for either of these, that usually means that you cut some corners and you didn't really make all the measurements or something like that. So, does that make sense? So, being able to really tell the difference between these two things, and hopefully in our experiments throughout the semester, you'll get some real experience on what those two things are. Okay? Good with that? All right. Let's talk about sig fig rules as a way to properly report measurements and as a way to properly report answers to calculations, for instance. Okay? So in every proper measurement, and sig figs really only apply to measurements. They do not apply to exact numbers. Exact numbers come from definitions or something, or counting or something. These don't work for that. Significant figures are always come about when we have an uncertain digit. Let's write it that way. So, every proper measurement has one uncertain digit to it. Significant figures will help us keep that uncertainty, will help us keep track of that uncertainty through calculations, right? So, if I have a measurement, if I have measured it properly with one uncertain digit, then significant figures are any digits that are non-zero. So in your measurement, anything 1 through 9 counts as a significant digit. Any trapped zero will count. So those are zeros in between non-zeros. And then any trailing zeros are significant if there's a decimal point. So if there's a decimal point anywhere in that number, then all of the trailing zeros. So trailing zeros are off to the right. So ones that are continuing on past the decimal point. So if there's a decimal point, trailing zeros are considered to be significant. Leading zeros are never significant. Leading zeros are to the left. So zeros that are to the left of all of the non-zero digits. So whether it's on either side of the decimal point, leading zeros are never significant. Trailing zeros, we assume them to not be significant if there's no decimal point. So we actually, if there's no decimal point, if there's a number like 47,000 with no decimal point, then those trailing zeros, we actually don't know whether there's actually any significance to them in a measured sense. We don't know whether that uncertain digit is that first zero, the second zero, the third zero, or neither. So we sort of assume the worst in that we say that trailing zeros are not significant. So that's since if we don't know it, we sort of assume the worst for it. So let's just consider this very first one right here. 0.01020. Let's identify these types of zeros. These first two zeros, using these kind of terms here, what are these first two zeros called? Leading zeros, okay? This one right here, can't see my little dot, this one right here. What do I call that? Trapped? And that one? Trailing. Okay? So, leading zeros, significant or not? No. This one is significant. Trapped zero, significant? Yes. Two is, since it's on zero. This trailing zero, is it significant? Yes. So, there are four sig figs in that number. Okay? So, do that same thing with these remaining three and compare those answers with the people in your group. Notice here's one with no decimal point. So, make that assumption that we talked about. So write them out and compare. What do you guys over here say for 42,000? Two? Let's say two sig figs at least. But we only know these two for sure. Okay? In other words, if this number two were the uncertain digit, then it would be just those two. But if we had an uncertain digit way up here, there could be more, but there's no way to tell just based on how that number is actually written. Okay? So let's just write two at least for that. In the back middle there, what'd you say for 42,000 with a decimal point? Works for me. Okay. And then you three over there, what did one of you say for the number in scientific notation here?
Three.
Yeah. Notice, all three of these values here are the same numerically. Right? 4.20 times 10 to the 4, right? 1, 2, 3, 4. Okay? All of these are the same numerically. It's just they have different precision to them. That means they were measured with some sort of different device. This one right here we can assume is uncertain there. This one is uncertain in the ones place. So that's the digit that was estimated. This one right here, that's the digit that was estimated. So a proper measurement, the uncertain digit will always be the last of the significant figures. But even though it's uncertain, even though it has a little plus or minus to it, it still has meaning in terms of the measurement. These zeros behind here are just placeholders. They have no meaning in the actual measurement that was recorded other than just making it into the right place. Okay? This isn't just 42, it's still 42,000, but this is the number right here that we're less certain of. Okay? So the real use for significant figures is when we're doing calculations. So first we have to identify how many sig figs there are, then we use those in order to tell us how to round our answer. So when we multiply or divide, we round our answer to the measurement that has the fewest number of significant figures. Okay? So type this one out, punch that into your calculator, get a number. Count up sig figs for both of those numbers, and whichever one has fewest, that's how you'll round your answer. So how many significant figures did you round your answer to? Two. That's right, because even though there were three up on top, there were two on the bottom of this. Okay? So what did you get? Somebody in the front over here, what did you get? 2 point what? 2.2? Yep. That's right. Okay? For adding or subtracting, we no longer actually count significant figures. We round to whichever has the fewest number of decimal places. That's because when I have an uncertain digit and I'm adding or subtracting, that uncertainty will be fixed in that certain decimal place. So right here, this uncertain digit in the tenths place. Over here, this uncertain digit is in the hundredths place. Which one of these, the variation, let's say this one more clearly. This one will be varying somewhere in the tenths place, right? This could be 0.4 or 0.2 or something. This is the one where there's variation, right? This one has variation in the hundredths place. Which of these, the one in the tenths place or the hundredths place, will be important to our to the sum of those digits? Yeah, because adding 0.1 to it is going to have more of an effect than adding 0.01 to it. Whatever variation there was in the hundredths place here will be totally drowned out by this variation that's in the tenths place. And it's fixed in those certain places. That's why we have to just consider decimal places. So how many decimal places will this answer have? One? So, what'd you get? 13.1. 13.5? Yeah. Just one decimal place. Up here we had two sig figs. Okay. The key is then, whenever we have a calculation that's a combination of several steps, we keep track of significant figures along the way, but you only do one rounding at the end. What would be the problem if, in a problem like this, right, you're going to add the stuff on the top, you're going to subtract the stuff on the bottom, then you're going to divide by each other. What would be the problem if I rounded after each step? How come that's not? What's that?
It wouldn't be very accurate.
Yeah, every time we round, we're decreasing the accuracy of that number. We're introducing a little bit of error. And to minimize that error, we're going to keep track of what digits count and which ones don't, but we're only going to remove digits at the very end. Okay? So we're going to keep all the results of our calculations throughout the entire thing, but then only once at the end do we do a rounding. Okay? So up on the top of this fraction here, 12.34 plus 1.3, what's your calculator give you, 13.64 or something like that? I'm just doing this in my head, so tell me if I'm wrong. Is that right on top? Okay. So that's what your calculator tells you to. If you were rounding right then, where would you round it to? Yeah, you'd round it to the 6. So what I like to do is underline the place where I would normally round, right? Because here's two decimal places, here's one decimal place. So I underline that, but I don't round it yet. Keep the digits. Okay? So you're subtracting. I don't feel like doing this one in my head. What do you get on the bottom? Say it a little louder, someone.
12.44.
Okay. So 1, 2, 3 decimal places. 1, 2. What number should I underline in this 12.446? Second four, right? So that's the second decimal place. Now, when I divide that, I keep all of these numbers, right? But then what rules do we use for rounding after I've divided? Sig figs. Okay? So round it and get an answer, but how many sig figs should this answer be rounded to?
Four. Three.
Now I've got 13.64. How many significant figures are in 13.64 with the 6 underlined. 3. That underline means we stop counting any whatever it is we're counting, whether it's sig figs or decimal places or whatever. Okay? So somebody from the back left over there, what's the answer that you got for this? I think. Mm-hmm. 1.10. Okay. Somebody from the front left over here. You guys get something? What's that? 1.10? What was it that your calculator actually told you? 1.095. Yep. So rounding that to 3 significant figures gave you 1.10. That make sense, everybody? So use those underlines to keep track along the way, but only perform the actual rounding when you're saying your answer. That make sense? So does that make sense? You were telling me that the sig fig rules were different than something else. Say that again? Mm-hmm. Rounding to the evens. And that's only if that 5 is it. Okay? In this case, right, well, you're rounding to the even anyway, but that rule would only take place if you just had this 5 and nothing else. Okay? In this case, this 5 right here is absolutely going to be closer to the one side. There's no argument about that either way. The only time that rounding to the even rule comes into play is if the one is exactly in between the two values and you don't know which way to go. So this one is definitely not exactly between the two values, so we don't even have to worry about that. So we run into that almost never in a class like this. That's why we don't even really talk about it. Okay? So essentially, when you're rounding, all I would do is look at this one digit right here, and if it's 5 or up, I round up, and if it's 4 or less, I round down, and that's it. Okay? Any questions? All right. So, let's see here. I can just use a second here. I didn't make a slide for it or anything, but here, there's actually room on this page. Mention scientific notation. Just briefly, and you've all, I'm sure, at some point run into scientific notation, but that's what this was right up here, right? When we multiply something by a power of 10 in order to get its true value. So if I had this number right here, 14000, say you got that in your calculator, okay, and the calculation says that this should have 3 sig figs. Having it just written out like that, there's no way of clearly showing 3 sig figs, is there? Right? If I had it just like that, all I could assume were the 2. If I put a decimal point on the end, I'd have 5. So there's no clear way of showing 3 sig figs for that. So that's where a number like that needs to go into scientific notation, because scientific notation has a decimal point and will always clearly show the correct number of sig figs. So start with a decimal point there. Proper scientific notation will have just one number to the left of the decimal point. So how many places will this decimal point have to move?
4.
4, right? 1, 2, 3, 4. So our number will be 1.40. We moved it 4 places. So is it going to be times 10 to the positive 4 or 10 to the negative 4, though? Well, let's think about this. Here's our actual number, 14,000. Okay? Population of a small town, something like that, 14,000. Okay? If I have 1.40, what do I have to do to 1.40 to make it into 14,000? Do I have to make it smaller or make it bigger? Yeah, I have to make it bigger. So what should I multiply it by? 10 to the positive 4 or 10 to the negative 4? Yeah. Positive exponent. Makes it a big number. Okay? It's really a shame when a student gets a whole problem wrong or something like that because they were confused by whether to make it positive or negative, and it's actually a pretty common mistake. So what I have you keep in mind is ask yourself whether your number should be a big number or whether it should be a small number. This is a big number, right? 10 to the 4 will make it into a big number. If I had something like 1.23 times 10 to the minus 4, is that going to be a big number or a small number? Small number, right? That's going to be 0.000123, right? Because I had to move this 4 times. I had to add a couple of placeholder zeros. We'll get that into standard notation like that. Okay? So negative 4, small number. Okay? So that's just a real simple way, I think, of keeping it in your head, is that in scientific notation, 10 to a positive number will be a very large number, 10 to a negative number will be a very small number. So I recommend against trying to memorize whether you're always going left or going right for this or that, because it's going to be different whether you're going from scientific to standard or standard to scientific. Right? So what will always be the same is that 10 to the negative 4 will give you a small number, 10 to the positive 4 will give you a large number. Does that make sense? Right. So let's do some unit conversion here. Let's do some dimensional analysis before we go. So I have a conversion factor for you right there. The actual definition between the English and metric length system is this one. 1 inch is actually exactly 2.54 centimeters. That's the definition between those two scales. So what I can do, I can make conversion factors out of that. This is just an equation. Okay? And conversion factors are in the form of a fraction, where the thing on the top and the thing on the bottom both represent the same thing. You can multiply anything by 1. So if you have a fraction with the same thing on the top and the bottom, that keeps your value the same. So there are 2 ways to make a fraction out of this, right? 1 inch over 2.54 centimeters, or 2.54 centimeters over 1 inch, right? So, simple question. How many centimeters are in 4.358 inches? To do dimensional analysis, you start with that value that you were given. What's the given? And then you multiply by whichever conversion factor will cancel that unit. So, what do you think? The one on the left or the one on the right? Which one of those will cancel the original unit? The one on the right will. Because when I have just a single value there, that's sort of like a fraction. That's essentially like a fraction over 1. So, that's on top. I'm going to multiply that by 2.54 centimeters over 1 inch. We can indicate then that inch unit cancels because I have inches on the top divided by inches on the bottom. And that just tells you what math to do. Okay? It tells you to do 4.358 times 2.54. Punch that into your calculator. When you're rounding, keep in mind that this is an exact conversion. This one right here is. 4.358 inches is some measurement that we got from somewhere. Okay. So, how many significant figures should be in the answer to this one? Three? Remember, significant figures are what keep track of where that uncertain digit is. Where is the uncertain digit in 1 inch equals 2.54? Where is the uncertain digit in? There is none. Okay? That's an exact conversion. So multiplying or dividing anything by an exact conversion will have no impact on significant figures. Right? This one over here, 4.358, how many sig figs does that have, though? So that being exact, I won't round anything by that. What do we have to get to? Yeah, I've heard from a lot of people so far. You guys up there, get an answer? Okay. How many sig figs should be in the answer?
Oh, four.
Four sig figs in the answer. Okay. Let's see here. Front group then. What one are you getting? 11.07? Four sig figs. Okay. That's pretty simple. Let's use some unit conversion to do a conversion between two SI prefixes. Okay. Micro and kilo. On the sheet last time, micro is 10 to the minus 6. Kilo is 10 to the 3. Okay? So, if I were to set up conversion factors and go step by step in order to get from micrometers to kilometers, it would probably be best for us to go through one unit in the middle. What should I go through?
Meters,
right? Let's go micrometers to meters to kilometers. Okay? So, we can set up something like that. What unit has to go on the bottom of the first fraction? Micrometers, for it to cancel. And if I'm converting that into meters, right, that'll go on the top of that fraction. What unit has to go on the bottom of the second fraction? Meters. And on the top of that one, what? Kilo. It is. All right. Let me help you out a little bit. If that micro prefix actually means 10 to the minus 6, then 1 micrometer equals how many meters? That's absolutely right. 10 to the minus 6. Okay. 1 kilometer equals how many meters? Okay. So, take just a moment. Take just a moment. Fill out these two conversion factors using what we have there. And then see if you can't, along with your group, maybe you need your calculator, it doesn't matter, you can figure something out. So just take a second and use these in order to try to get an answer in kilometers. Okay. It would actually be helpful if we had a number here in scientific notation. So, fill the numbers out in that one. I gave you the framework for it. Fill the numbers out. If you're stuck, compare it with the other people in your group. Then have that.
Do the math.
If you had them written out there, in those fractions, you can simplify those powers of 10.
So, like we were talking about, there's about a million ways of doing this calculation, but it's all the same math. It should all get you to the same place. So, if I were just substituting my powers of 10, I would have put 10 to the minus 6 meters per 1 micrometer, 10 to the 3 meters per 1 kilometer. That's one way of doing it. Before we get an answer here, let's just think a little bit about some of the different ways that this could be handled. What if I only wanted positive powers of 10? What could I have done over on this one if I only wanted to use positive powers of 10? Yeah, 1 meter is 10 to the 6 micrometers. Okay? That doesn't come from the official definition, but that's using the reciprocal. Right, that's using the inverse of it, like we talked about using before. So sometimes that can make things a little easier if you're simplifying the powers of 10. I think, and you'll have to find which way works best for you, but I've found anyway that you're least likely to make mistakes if you stick with the actual definitions. Right? And if you have the actual number here in front of the base unit. So here's meters. We put some number in front of the base unit that equals the other prefix. Here's meter. I put the number in front of the base unit that equals that prefix. So that, I think that's the most consistent way of doing it, because you'll always have a number in front of this base unit that's equal to this prefix, so that the top and the bottom of this fraction are actually equal to each other. That makes sense? It is actually a fairly common mistake for somebody to put 10 to the minus 6 in front of micro, but that doesn't make sense because you'd have 10 to the minus 6 times another 10 to the minus 6. This micro right here is 10 to the minus 6 itself. So you spread those things out on the top and the bottom. So ultimately, what you're doing, though, no matter how you do it, you'll be dividing by 10 to the minus 9. So if you want to, and I think a quick way of typing this in your calculator would be 148 times 1e minus 6 divided by 1e3. That's just one way of doing it. If you want to be using the 10 with the caret and stuff like that, you might have to be a little careful about parentheses if you're dividing it or something like that. If you just did divide by 10, or divide by 10 caret 6 or something like that, you might have a little trouble with order of operations. So, or you could bring this 3 up to the top and make it minus, okay, and just add those together, essentially. So, how many sig figs did you have in this answer?
3.
So 1.48 times 10 to the what? Yeah. Minus 7. That's what I got. And if you didn't get minus 7, that means something went wrong in the way you entered it in your calculator or something like that. Okay? So here's one more that I'll just have you practice with. I'll give you these prefixes. Mega is 10 to the 6. Nano is 10 to the minus 9. Okay? So set this up however you like. Do it in a way that works for you, but compare your answer with the people around you to see if you actually got the same thing for this. So this one can be performed really just like the one that was above it. All right. Let's see here. I should keep a tally of who I've talked to and who I haven't. I'm still working. We'll just go through this piece by piece. You guys over here, what'd you put on the bottom of the first fraction? How many? Sure. Okay. And if you put 1 megagram on the bottom, what'd you put up on the top? Sure. Works for me. All right. Next group over. What did you put on the bottom of your second fraction? I'm just curious.
Grams.
And on the bottom, or on the top, what unit? Grams into nanograms. All right. What did you use in front of your grams? You used 1? If you used 1 in front of your grams, what did you use in front of nanograms? 10 to the 9. That would work. Who's somebody that used something different than 1 on the bottom of, in front of grams?
10
to the negative 9 grams. Oops, 10 to the minus g. 10 to the minus 9. And on top, what'd you put?
1.
Everybody see how these are equal expressions to each other? These are totally the same. The one on the bottom came from the actual definition. The one on the top came from flipping that So you have 10 to the 9 of those small units in 1 gram. They'll get you the same answer. Okay? So 3.1 times 10 to the, what exponent did you get in the front down here? What'd you get?
12.
No, 12 is what I got. Okay. So what I wanted to show you before you leave here on our 1061 webpage, I have a couple of practice worksheets that'll give you some extra practice doing this sort of thing. This is just a real key skill for you to have, and if you don't get this down right away, it's going to cause you troubles from here on out. So I have this SI prefix conversion worksheet that'll be really helpful to you. You don't need to do this whole thing, but do, you know, what you need. I have a section where converting to or from a base unit. Okay. The next page, converting between units with two different prefixes. Okay. So that's the practice. There is a key where I have them all worked out using at least a couple of different methods. So, for instance, here's one where I worked it out using the actual definition of centi as 10 to the minus 2. Okay. Here's one where I flipped it, so I'm using only positive exponents. But you can use whichever way that you like. But I would recommend you at least work through some of that just to make sure that you are comfortable with that method. Okay? So we'll finish just the last little bit of Chapter 1 next time, but we will also get a good start on Chapter 2. So at least have the first half or so of Chapter 2 read in your textbook for next time.
Maybe have it open so we can print it, Chapter
2. Oh, the notes, I'll have those up this afternoon.
Okay.
Yeah, I'll have those blank notes up so you can print those out. I'll do Chapter 2 and Chapter 3 at the same time. Okay? Have those this afternoon. Okay? We'll meet you in the lab in a little bit.
Why do we go to the bigger one for rounding? Because when you go to the smaller one, so then it'd only be 1.1?
Nope. You're dividing, so it's based on significant figures.
Okay.
Right? 1, 2,
but
3.
But when does the rounding then just not matter?
Say that again.
Does the rounding of that then not matter?
Does the rounding of that not matter?
Because the underline of it doesn't seem to have an effect for that.
This underline here is what determines that we save the third digit. Because 1, 2, 3, yep. If I had another digit here, that would have been out here, so our answer would have gotten one more digit.
Okay.
So you're dividing, so you're actually counting how many numbers there are.
Okay.